Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
February 28th, 2019. Thank you for joining me yet again. So much of what goes on around us today is cultivated, manipulated, utterly manufactured. So it can be pretty difficult to ascertain what is and what's not legitimate, true, genuine. There's no good answer to that, no secret to figuring it all out. Sadly, we've been quietly built into a prison of our own minds, a prison of which we cannot even see, and one which most still actually maintain does not exist at all, wherein everything can be crafted and controlled to such a degree that reality itself can now be put into question. This idea alone makes many choose to just ignore it and check out. But for those with the Constitution to stand against this effort, the only real solution is to question everything. Be open to all possibilities, especially the ones that you or I are certain are fake, right? Be open to those possibilities more so than anything else, but be equally skeptical of all information coming your way, all sources. As in this brave new world, everything can be deceptive. And it should go without saying that chief among the sources that should be questioned is the government that has been caught lying and deceiving an immeasurable amount throughout even just our recent history. So keep this in mind in general as we go through the actual news of the day. So for the first story, we're going to get into something that I've been following over for a long time, actually, for a very long time, but something that I've been following recently as it's been getting, finding its way into the headline news in regard to Pakistan and India. It's a story that I wanted to follow up on and really dive into so people can see what's happened to this point and maybe some my take on where this may be going and how it could be used. This coming from 21st Century Wire, entitled "Pakistan Shoots Down Two Indian Jets Inside Pakistan Airspace, India Retaliates." Now, there is a lot of information flying around about this story, about what's been going on, and a lot of misinformation and false claims and everything from all over the place. So I wanted to go through what's happened so far so people know generally what we're looking at with this story. So two nuclear powers are currently engaged in a tit-for-tat military exchange that could very easily escalate into a nuclear war. Now, this heated situation has been brewing for years, for a very long time. On February 14th, a suicide car bomb hit a police convoy in Pulwama in the Indian-controlled part of Kashmir. The attack reportedly killed 40 Indian soldiers and injured many others. Now, the Pakistan-based terrorist group Jaish-e-Mohammed, or JEM, claimed responsibility and uploaded a video of the attacker. Now, Pakistan denied any involvement in the incident and called for a joint investigation. So, there's this interesting development here of the, fighting terrorism in another location. Right? Similar to how the U.S. frames everything it's doing as fighting terrorism in another play, in another sovereign territory. But because you've got terrorists there, we're allowed to just circumvent international law. So there's a part of that taking place here where we have something that happened, a suicide bomb attack that a group associated with, or rather based in Pakistan, takes claim for it. And India is now then, holding Pakistan accountable. But again, we're talking about, and it gets deeper into the back and forth of it all. So after Pakistan has denied involvement in the incident whatsoever, is now calling for this joint investigation. Now, after the suicide attack, the Indian Prime Minister Modi immediately threatened to retaliate against Pakistan specifically. And he did so yesterday, which is where this got really, really out of hand. Retaliating essentially based off of what they're saying is just a terrorist attack they had nothing to do with. Now, in an elaborate operation, Indian fighter jets released Israeli-made Specie 2000 heavy-guided bombs purchased from Israel against an alleged, JEM terrorist training camp near Balakot. Now, India made explicit that it hit a non-military target, which is an interesting thing to claim because you're saying that you're fighting back against an attack that Pakistan's responsible for. It's very interesting in the way it's developed. But I find it very interesting that India's using Israeli-made weapons that they've bought. Now, air traffic over Pakistan and West India was completely shut down at this point. Now, India has about 140 nuclear weapons, while Pakistan has about 100. So Pakistan's conventional military is inferior, basically in every way, to India's. It follows the doctrine of asymmetric escalation, which allows for nuclear strikes in response to conventional military attacks. So the idea is that they can then respond with a military strike, knowing that they're weaker than the other side, before it reaches that level, which is a very alarming thing. It's similar to the way the U.S. stands with the basically the kind of ambiguous doctrine that they're open to striking first with military attacks. It changes a lot of things, and that's why this specific situation is very, very alarming. Now, what's also interesting is that even though India is using Israeli-supplied weapons in this, what I would say is an oddly timed skirmish, is that India also stands with Russia and China in regard to U.S. intervention in Venezuela, as in they're against it. So there's some kind of conflicting points of interest here overall. It's also important to recognize that both Pakistan and India are generally on good terms with the United States. So this whole situation, you could argue, could be being used in a way to just draw your attention probably largely away from the overtly failed coup that's taking place in Venezuela. That's just a guess, something off the top of my head that seems like it could be possible, because this has been a brewing conflict for a long time that hasn't gotten as much attention. But clearly this has been more escalation than we've seen in a very long time. Now, with the situation where it is, Pakistan could not leave the strike within its own borders without a response. So not responding would set essentially a precedent to invite further Indian attacks as they see it. Now, on the 27th, yesterday, two Pakistani J-17A jets flew into the airspace of Indian-controlled Kashmir and released bombs against what its military then claimed was a non-military target. So clearly one thing we have to recognize in the world of military today, military actions and wartime, we have to, there's a factor that plays today that never really took was considered a long time ago, and that is of, you know, the social media following, the propagandizing the story, like coming out with their talking points before it's even brought to light, which both of them now saying non-military targets. I find that interesting. It says, we have no intention of escalation, but are fully prepared to do so if forced into that paradigm. That is why we undertook the action with clear warning and in broad daylight. Now, two rather antique Indian MiG-21 jets scrambled to chase the Pakistani fighter jets away. They were lured into the Pakistani-controlled airspace, and they were both shot down. So it's clearly that we're far, far past the non-military targets at this point. Now, additionally, India also falsely claimed that it shot down a Pakistani F-16 jet. Again, in this new age of propaganda, where they're just same thing we're seeing in Venezuela right now. It's just simply saying things in hopes that it gets spread by the lapdog media that are simply not true. Now, Pakistan published pictures of one of the downed jets and claimed that the other one fell into the Indian-controlled area. Now, an Indian pilot ejected from his plane and was captured by Pakistani troops, who had trouble keeping the locals from actually lynching him as they drug him through. Now, the captured pilot was blindfolded and interrogated, and he identified as Wing Commander Abhi Nandan, service number 27981, and he actually did not respond to any further questions.
I've got hurt, and I would say some again. Water, please.
Start again, please.
Yeah, my name is Wing Commander Abhi Nandan. My service number is 27981. I'm a flying pilot, and my religion is Hindu.
Okay. What else?
I'm sorry, sir. As per, that's all I'm supposed to tell you.
Okay.
Wing Commander Abhi Nandan.
Yes.
Pardon? I'm not supposed to tell you that, no?
Okay.
How's
that, Mr. Fadji? Don't you already tell everything?
Am I speaking to an officer?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. May I request a little bit of information? Am I with the Pakistani army?
Now, there's been a lot of backlash about this, saying that they violated the Geneva Convention by simply putting this information out there, the image of him and what's taking place. And that's being disputed by a lot of people right now. Now, throughout the early evening on Wednesday, yesterday, there were increasing reports of tanks and heavy artillery being amassed along the border on both sides, including video evidence showing of these tanks lining up, specifically near the Pakistani border town of Sialkot, where video appears to confirm these deployments right along the border. Now, China, Russia, and the United States have urged both sides to stand down and to de-escalate the situation. Now, what would be interesting is if there was a difference of alliances here, right? If one of these countries was not aligned with the U.S., there'd be probably a Venezuela-type situation taking place. But now they're basically just staying out of it, saying, you know, you should both stand down. Seemingly what you think they would be doing with any other country, but no, when it suits their interests, they feel morally obligated to get involved. See, it's a difference there. It's funny. But there's much, and again, there's much worse things happening around the world, some of which are directly, the U.S. is directly responsible for, that don't get talked about while they're making sure everybody looks at Venezuela. Now, Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi told Pakistani television station GOTV on Thursday that, quote, "We are willing to return the captured Indian pilot if it leads to de-escalation." And as of today, Prime Minister Imran Khan said that the captured pilot would be released as a, quote, "gesture of goodwill" on Friday, seemingly leading in a direction of de-escalation. Now, India and Pakistan have continued exchanging conventional arms fire across the contested border in Kashmir as of the starting of this show. But this has been something that's been ongoing for a long time. Now, as Mood of Alabama wrote, "Not responding to today's attack, or rather yesterday's attack, will let Indian Prime Minister Modi look weak and may well cost him his upcoming election, which I guarantee plays a factor in all of this. Responding with a new attack on Pakistan will gravely endanger both countries." So the question is whether he's willing to risk nuclear war to help his political career. I think we know where that tends to go with politicians these days. Now, the eruption of open conflict was definitely a surprise on both sides, as it's been seeming to de-escalate over this long fight. This heated conflict has continued to de-escalate for a while now, and only hours before it was seemingly to come down quite a bit. But then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Pakistan's priority was to avoid military action and take, quote, "meaningful action against terrorist groups operating on its soil." So clearly putting the buck on Pakistan and saying that it's their priority to avoid taking further action, and then saying, well, because you've got terrorists on your area, that's something you have to deal with, which is just very interesting. We have to take into consideration what the U.S. and its actions are doing to other foreign policy around the world, claiming that just because you see something as the right thing to do, claiming because there's a bad guy there that we've acknowledged as a bad guy, that we claim as a bad guy, so we're allowed to circumvent international law and all of your other rights just because we think that's a bad person. So think of how this plays into this dynamic with India and Pakistan and saying, oh, well, we were just attacking a terrorist group that just hit us that was on your territory. But think of the logic as it applies to the United States. How do you think the United States would respond if Mexico attacked Texas, saying that there were extremists in Texas that were fighting against Mexico? See how that doesn't work both ways? And this is the hypocrisy of all of this foreign policy. So as this continues to develop, we will continue to follow up on how it goes forward. Something tells me that there's more involved in this story and why it's happening now in regard to, as you know, when Yemen is worse off than it's ever been, while they're failing overtly in their effort to overthrow Venezuela, while they're about to kick off overthrowing efforts in Cuba and Nicaragua, while Syria is failing, while Afghanistan, I mean, all these things that are going on. It's just interesting, the timing of it all. So we'll keep track of it and we'll follow up as it continues to develop. Now, for another story in regard to foreign policy that I wanted to follow up on, some of this that we've already touched on before, but a very excellent article by Venezuela Analysis entitled "Debunking Four Myths Truths About Venezuela's Humanitarian Aid Showdown." Now, this is something, if you've been watching this show, almost all of this you've probably heard, but there's a couple of interesting points they added, and I wanted to go through this again just to be very clear. I know I talk fast. I know some people don't like that. So I want to make sure that we go through these points again, because this is a very big deal. That the trucks being said, the lies being told around what's going on, not just the lies being told, but how unusually obvious they are, how unusually easy it is to see that they're lying. And yet they're still lying about this. To this very moment, the mainstream media and the government are putting two that you clearly know about, who set the trucks on fire, and the fact that that's the only aid trying to get through. That is obnoxiously obvious to find out, to look into and find out that's not true. And they're still pushing it. So let's go through the four mistruths that Venezuela Analysis thinks are the most important. And I do agree. Great article. Number one, who burnt the aid trucks? Right, which we just talked about. And again, if you've been watching this show, you know how that went down, as we've showed this multiple times. And as always, this is very easy to find. The information is out there. You can see them throwing it for themselves. So the reality of who burnt it is very easy. The Guaido side, the U.S. opposition side, are responsible for throwing the cocktail that set the truck on fire. As well as in the same video, you can see them setting up a whole staging area for Molotov cocktails. And you can tell that everyone on the government side had nothing that was in, that could set to flame. They have rubber bullets, and nothing they were using could have set that truck on fire. Here they are creating all the Molotov cocktails. So mainstream media latched on to what is clearly an obvious false story, stating as fact that two trucks were burnt to a cinder by Maduro and two were stolen by Maduro's forces. This is coming from the Telegraph. But we know that's not true. We know that that's not true because it's been shown very clearly not to be true, and not just by Maduro forces, but by people on this side, including organizations that don't agree with how obviously militarized and politicized the U.S. aid effort truly was. And this is important to understand that they clearly have evidence that they set it on, that Guaido's side set these on fire, and yet both the government and the media to this very day are still pretending. Just like they still pretend that Syria attacked the civilians or they carried out chemical weapons attacks, even though we have proof that that's not the case. They still say it anyway. Now, even at the Lima Group summit, which we've talked about, of the 12 Latin American countries with Canada and the United States, it was held in the Colombian capital, Bogota, on Monday. No coincidence that Guaido and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence brazenly spouted lies about the sadistic Venezuelan military under President Nicolas Maduro had caused the destruction of the vital aid supplies intended for suffering people. The fact that this was the timing of when this was held, clearly the point is they set this event up so they could follow it up with this and come out and point out about, oh, look at what they did. They didn't let the aid through or they set it on fire, all things they were planning to do. That we know are clear lies. Now, Venezuelan communications minister Jorge Rodriguez, for his part, has alleged that the protesters were actually paid. So we know they set that on fire, but he's saying they were paid to set the trucks on fire, pointing to a specific video of a scuffle between opposition supporters and Venezuelan National Assembly deputy Jose Manuel Olivares, who was in charge of the aid operation on the Venezuelan-Colombian border. Now understand, remember the National Assembly is the illegitimate government that Guaido associates with. So the scuffle was between opposition supporters and the Venezuelan National Assembly deputy. And he's saying that the claims of the fight was sparked by a payment dispute. And then also goes on to point out that a Venezuelan outlet interviewed a bunch of different people allegedly involved in the protest who openly claimed that they've been promised $4,000, mind you, for torching the truck. Pretty damn obvious information. Now, anything could be faked, but you show me one thing coming from the other side there of any way, shape, or form that's evidence that Maduro was responsible for the fires. Show me that one thing and I'll talk about it. But on this case, we've got countless amounts of information that show you pretty obviously proof that they did it. And yet they're still lying about it. Number two, is Maduro government really blocking international humanitarian assistance? Again, something that we know is not true. Something we've showed ridiculous amount of times that's coming from all kinds of different places. Only 48 hours before February 23rd, the border showdown, Maduro actually announced that his government was coordinating $2 billion worth of U.S. $1 billion worth of technical humanitarian assistance with the United Nations and the EU-led international contact group. So this was 2 days before this happened, and they were already getting other things. This was close to 20 times what the U.S. and its allies have pledged to Venezuela. So think of how ridiculous it is for the United States to continue to say that that's the only thing getting in, while just in this one case, we're talking about 20 times the small amount the U.S. was trying to force through with Venezuelan money. That's not to mention the idea you're looking at right there, the 933 tons coming from multiple locations, and another 300 that came from Russia, and on and on. It was also reported that Venezuelan authorities supplied the UN and EU with a list of medicines, which they have been unable to purchase in the international market, largely as a result of, guess what, the US-led financial sanctions. So all these claims that the medicine getting through, not hurting the people, the literally all the things they can't get because of US sanctions and blockades, that is literally hurting the people. But the point is they gave this list out before saying, these are all things we want and you can bring them in for us. Now, Maduro committed his government to buying all food products which Brazil is willing to sell them, and announced that a 7.5-ton shipment of medicines from Russia had just arrived in the Caribbean nation over the weekend in coordination with the Pan American Health Organization. On and on it goes, but the U.S., the media, and the government right now want you to believe that nothing else has gotten through, and Maduro is trying to starve people to death, and that's why he wouldn't let their fake weapons, humanitarian aid shipment ploy go through. Now, the corporate mainstream media has conveniently ignored the pointed criticisms, of course, you know, conveniently ignored the pointed criticisms voiced by the United Nations and the Red Cross and over 70 Venezuelan international humanitarian organizations over Washington's politicization of the aid effort. Excuse me. And this is something we reported on countless times. With the United Nations, the Red Cross, countless other organizations have overtly said that Washington is militarizing this aid. They're using this for political purposes to manipulate things, and aid should not be politicized. It's just like we pointed out that USAID, the group they're using, literally in their own information says that they're working for in favor of the National Assembly. That is literally politicizing the aid. That's what they're talking about. Shouldn't be a big surprise. This is what the U.S. does. Now, number three, how many soldiers deserted? Now, here's where this gets interesting. This is something I haven't seen a lot of people talk about. Now, the international media is regurgitating unsubstantiated claims from the U.S. government, you know, like it usually does, Colombian authorities, and the Organization of American States, the OAS, that more than 100 Venezuelan soldiers deserted on February 23rd, a figure which Mike Pence elevated to just 200 on Monday, just because. Colombian authorities further increased their official count to over 300 on Tuesday. This keeps going up. To date, no clear evidence for these claims has been provided. And given the political interests of the players, they should elicit some extreme skepticism. But just think about the idea that this is what we're... So if anyone that actually watched the footage on the 23rd or anything of all of it, the only thing you'll see is a few, three at the most, or four people who actually almost killed people in their attempt to rush across the border, where they were then treated like heroes as they almost killed one pregnant woman that was in the way. But if anyone watching it, you can see only just a few people getting by. But they want you to believe 300 people deserted. And this, again, is the idea of the modern concept of war and propaganda we're talking about. That as long as they can say it and they get enough people talking about it, they can get you believing that's what actually happened. And the hope is to get the military to believe, oh, no, everyone's deserting. Maybe we should just go. They want that watershed moment. It's just simply not happening. They're overtly lying about how many people actually went across. Now, they've published a photo in the BBC with only 7 soldiers. And in there, claiming that hundreds of people deserted. Funny how that works. And you can see the photo right here. Now, the most famous desertion, the defectors, took place on the early hours of February 23rd, which we covered at the time. And the video footage shows Venezuelan opposition activists on the Colombian side after they rammed these cars across the border, injuring people like I just talked about, which many people say looks like they intentionally tried to hit civilians to make this the case. But the video footage shows Venezuelan opposition activists on the Colombian side telling the local police after this happened that the deserters are they're ours. They're with us. That's a quote. They're on our side, they said, hinting that it may have been a pre-planned desertion, meaning that they pre-planned the whole thing, including the hurting of civilians. And this, as always, is the U.S. side that we're talking about here. Think about that. Now, number four, the last one. Did the supposed aid we're talking about, did it contain medicine? Did it contain the things that they said it did? It's an honest question. After all the lies we're seeing and all the lies they're pushing forward that anyone can see if they just choose to look at it, that's brazen for you. The real question should be, did it even have what they said it did? Now, we just talked about Areza showing that it was wire and nails and things, and it wasn't what they said it was. Well, here, this gets even more interesting, where it turns out, and here's the picture that I showed just the other day, but it turns out that it didn't contain any medicine whatsoever. This, and as just one of many canards that they're throwing out, these lies of this entire story, so easy to see. And of course, dutifully reproduced by the international media, is this notion that Washington's aid shipment contained, in addition to food, was essential medicines for sick Venezuelans condemned to die by Maduro. Of course, that's their line. It says, quote, almost 200 tons of aid in a convoy of trucks has been waiting to cross several border bridges, including food and medicine. And the tear gas was fired as protesters tried to stop the aid from being destroyed. That's according to Sky News. Right, this is Sky News, and this is, again, they're saying that they were firing tear gas to try to stop the protesters from putting out the fire. Understand. That's what they're trying to tell you there. Even though we have video of them starting it, video of them planning it, video, you know, evidence of all this stuff. But yet Sky News just says, what's that, master? Yes. Oh, yep. Report this. Okay, because we're lapdog establishment propagandists, that's what we do. They don't even look into this stuff. Do you think a real journalist wouldn't have seen this video that's everywhere on the internet? Of course they would. They don't care. They're trying to lie to you. And the point was, there wasn't medicine at all. Now, as the article points out, this claim has been called into question ever since Saturday. Even according to the New York Times, the trucks that the opposition tried to force across the border contained, quote, no medicine at all, with reports that a, quote, small amount of medicine was being stockpiled in Cucuta, not Venezuela, not confirmed by the USAID. Now, in initial inventories from USAID, the propaganda group, the NGO that does things secretly for regime change, as they all do, made no mention of medicine, listing only basic food and personal hygiene products among the aid. So not even USAID's own information showed that they had medicine. And yet, they're all saying that. They're all pushing the medicine, all the politicians, the Trump administration, the media, and it's just simply not true. How many things do we need to see before we stand back and go, yeah, they're probably lying to us? Even if in their minds they think they're doing it for a good reason, they're not informing you. And it's damn time you woke up to that for all those that may just be tuning in. But let's move on to some other information. Since we're talking about Venezuela, and this is the idea they want you to be thinking about, how bad it is and what's really going on and how we all need to care about the humanitarian crisis that's happening in Venezuela. Well, as geopolitics puts it, forget Venezuela. 80% of Yemenis require urgent humanitarian aid, up 30% from last year. Now, this doesn't mean we shouldn't care about Venezuelans. I think we should care more about Venezuelans than just about anything right now because the U.S. is so overtly trying to overthrow their country. Not because there's this humanitarian crisis they want you to believe is there, which is pretty clear. It's not what they say it is. And at the very least, it's much, much, much less of a catastrophe than what's happening in Yemen or what's happening in Haiti. But ask yourself why they don't talk about those the same way. There's a reason for that. But the reality is that Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, by far. And the U.S. is helping and pushing it and making it happen. And no one's talking about that? This is a continual frustration for me. Because I've been talking about Yemen. The first strike I ever got on my channel was when I pointed out that they were killing civilians in Yemen, and they struck me down back before everyone was talking about it. Right. And now it's a pretty commonplace discussion. They just make sure the mainstream media doesn't talk about it. They damn sure won't censor me again because it's such an obvious topic. I can prove we all know it's happening. 80% require humanitarian aid. Serious. Now, as the article begins, while the world focuses on Venezuela to validate coup threats, the man-made humanitarian situation in Yemen continues deteriorating. In fact, the very country claiming to help alleviate Venezuelan suffering, the United States, has played an active and intentional role in creating the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Pretty cut and dry. And I like what they made in that point there, that the man-made humanitarian crisis. This isn't like some you know, dereliction or like they just weren't caring enough about the people or the government was lazy. This is a man-made crisis. Because of the bombings, because of the starvation, because of the bombing of water infrastructure, the cholera problem, this is being made by the United States, the Saudis, and the UAE, and whoever else is involved. That is a fact. You can argue why they're doing it, you know, what their altruistic reason for starving 20 million people might be, but you can't argue that they're not doing this intentionally. That's simply, that ship has sailed. Now, according to a recent report from ReliefWeb, 80% of Yemen's entire population, think about that. 80% of the entire country require urgent humanitarian assistance, meaning they are about to starve to death. Now, this figure is up 30% just from last year. That means out of an estimated population of 30.5 million people, we're now at 24.1 million that require immediate aid for survival. This is coming directly from ReliefWeb. Now, facing starvation and famine due to the blockade, the U.S.-Saudi blockade, the illegal U.S.-Saudi blockade, 20.1 million need urgent food assistance. Now, healthcare is also a vital concern. 19.7 million Yemenis lack basic access to doctors and life-saving medicines. Now, before you shrug this off as being some Middle East country, think about the fact that this was not the way it was before the U.S. and Saudi's efforts. So recognize the fact that what they're doing is literally blocking basic human rights from an entire country. Really try to reflect on that and what that might mean to you if this was happening in your state, in your city, in your country. that another country was blocking you because they wanted some kind of strategic point in your country to control that point. And they're willing to literally starve every single person in that country to get control of it. There's no way to misunderstand this. 19.7 million Yemenis lack basic access to doctors and life-saving medicines because of what the U.S. and the Saudis are doing. And to top it off, 17.8 million don't have a proper water sanitation or other supplies, or water sanitation systems or other supplies for keeping up with basic human hygiene. Not because they don't want it, not because they can't afford it, but because they do not have access to it because of U.S. and Saudi actions. Now, by looking at these numbers, it's easy to see that a majority of Yemenis need very urgent assistance in all three of these areas. Now, this is a major problem because the lack of access to clean water and sanitation and the equipment involved is directly responsible for the fatal spread of cholera. The only thing you really need to treat cholera effectively, clean water. Now, the UN expects to record up to 350,000 cases of cholera just in 2019. In 2017, 1 million were affected with the preventable illness, while several thousand died because of U.S. and Saudi actions. Now, instead of putting forth any efforts to lift the U.S. enforced and Saudi-led blockade and siege of Yemen, the UN has just simply appealed for $4.2 billion, you know, in money to meet the needs. So yeah, go ahead and keep murdering and killing and starving and bombing the stuff they get. We'll just elicit some of that or take some of that money from the people that are killing them, if that's even where it comes from, and give it back to the people while they're continuing to suffer. It's just, it's staggering that this is the only thing the UN seems that's capable of doing. And even that, it fails to do all too often. Now, the blockade, which is technically illegal under international law, and they do it anyway, restricts all land, sea, and air imports and exports. It also prohibits the free flow of human movement, which is an important one for me, which has effectively turned Yemen into yet another open-air prison. Now, this travel ban, combined with the country's failing healthcare system, has contributed to the death of over 27,000 civilians as of August 2018. It has also caused the death of over 247,000 children who are particularly vulnerable to starvation and disease. 247,000 children. Now, think about what they're trying to tell you should care about in Venezuela. Think about what they're trying to tell you should care about in Iran. And ask yourself if this is not monumentally worse, monumentally more important, monumentally more catastrophic for human rights and just humanity. And then ask yourself why this isn't on the mainstream media. Ask yourself why they don't want you talking about this. The answer is pretty simple. Now, during the month of December alone, Saudi coalition warplanes attacked 68 water tanks and pumps, 222 agricultural fields, 4 markets, 132 livestock, 4 wood warehouses, and much, much more. How many of these things you can explain as like a wayward missile? Ask yourself that. Now, to top it off, coalition airstrikes also targeted 190 businesses and factories, as well as airports, seaports, boats, and gas stations. You know, just general things for the well-being and livelihood of the average Yemeni. Not military installations and convoys, but houses, schools, water, food. That's what the U.S. and the Saudis are bombing. Now, the coalition airstrikes on vital civilian infrastructure make it very clear that starvation and disease from the blockade are not just byproducts, but intended weapons of war. Now, it's difficult to imagine how a country such as the United States could claim to support democracy and human rights in Venezuela, or anywhere else for that matter, while quite literally trampling on the rights of Yemenis, you know, while killing their families. Now, on a related note that I thought was important to share from Hussein al-Bukhadi, that literally why, and I just pointed this out about how the Yemenis were doing the same thing in support of Palestine, but literally while these people are being more oppressed, more, just try, I mean, nothing does it any justice to really try to encapsulate what these people are going through. Bombed daily, starving to death, eating leaf paste, suffering from disease. So while they're suffering from all of this, they still have the heart to stand up and support other groups that are suffering as well, such as the Palestinians. And in this case, they're standing in solidarity with Venezuela. As his tweet says, Yemenis from all parties gathered today, which I think this was the day before yesterday, in front of the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a in solidarity with Venezuela against U.S. interference. Literally, while they're being bombed into oblivion, the entire country starving to death, they have the heart to talk and care and protest for somebody else's suffering. Now, organizers stated that the U.S. is trying to destabilize all countries that stand with Palestine. I thought that was interesting. Their goal being to put someone loyal in a position of power or simply destroy the country. I think that aligns with what we know of U.S. foreign policy. But the idea that all this stems to the support of Palestine is pretty interesting. And you could make a very clear case why that makes sense. And you could just as easily make it about those who oppose Israel's foreign policy. So it all does seem to line up. But it's just very sad to see these people continue to suffer while they're literally, during their suffering, standing up and fighting for other people. Really makes you wonder what we should be doing with our free time. Now, for the final story of the day, this one that is very alarming to me coming from Mint Press News. Non-military federal agencies under Trump expand already enormous arsenals. This is the conspiracy theory. This is what we're talking about in regard to the IRS, the DHS, FEMA, all these different groups. The non-military federal agencies are now being armed to the teeth in this country. Yeah, but it's okay. Just keep looking at other things. Keep talking about the tabloid stories. Keep fighting amongst yourselves between left and right while they literally build us into the prison that a lot of us, believe we're already in. So it's an alarming scenario here. Now, the massive purchases of ammo and weapons by non-military federal agencies such as the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, and even the Social Security Administration that first actually began under Obama has continued unabated and increasing under the Trump administration, while receiving, of course, less media coverage, which isn't very surprising. Now, according to this report released last December by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, and recently highlighted by Forbes, the mass purchases of ammunition, weapons, and other military-grade items by ostensibly civilian government agencies has continued up through fiscal year 2017, the latest year for which data is available, and continuing to this point. They just can't show you the actual numbers until the years following. But it's continuing right up to this moment. Now, the report also found that many agencies had even misreported the amount and size of their ammo and weapons purchases to the GAO by a significant degree. In one case, the GAO, which is the Government Accountability Office, found that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, which is a hugely contentious group today, had actually spent 8 times more on weapons and ammo than it had disclosed to the office. Whoops. Our mistake. We actually spent 8 times more than we thought we did. This is just the inherent corruption, the same reason the Pentagon can fail its audit and no one cares. And this is the show of legitimacy. This is they put on the air, the dog and pony show. This is how we're all being held accountable, checks and balances, when it's all a bunch of BS. Now, the budget that had been proposed for fiscal year 2017, which ended on September 30, 2017, had originally been drafted under the Obama administration, but was amended by the Trump administration. And the massive purchases of ammo and weapons by non-military agencies were left completely as they were. Big surprise. Now, among the agencies that acquired ammunition, which are a lot of them, weapons and related equipment as well in fiscal year 2017 were the IRS actually spent $600,000 on ammunition. The IRS, but refused to disclose to the GAO what its intended purposes were and told the GAO that it could not provide data on firearms purchases. We're talking about the Internal Revenue Service. Why would they ever need ammunition to begin with? And why would they refuse to disclose what their purpose for it was? How is that not the most alarming thing anybody could ever hear? Now, the IRS has stated in the past that such purchases are used in, quote, investigating potential criminal violations of the Internal Revenue Code. You know, nonviolent criminals. Now, its current inventory is estimated to include 4,461 firearms, including submachine guns and over 5 million rounds of ammunition. The IRS. Now, first, if someone's, okay, maybe they're investigating some kind of a drug ring, you know, involved with, you know, defrauding the IRS. Now, do you really think that the IRS should be sending people in, or they should maybe say, hey, armed police, that your job is to deal with these things, let's work together, and you go in and deal with these armed criminals that we have a case on? It's just ridiculous to think that we need to arm all of these non-military groups. But there's clearly an agenda here because it goes far past the IRS. The Veterans Health Administration, the VHA, of the Department of Veterans Affairs purchased around 600 firearms and nearly 20,000 rams of ammunition, along with riot gear and camouflage uniforms. Now, the VHA has claimed that these purchases were for, quote, enforcing federal law at VA medical facilities. Now, the Office of the Inspector General, the OIG, of the Social Security Administration purchased around 300 firearms and 2,500 rounds of ammunition. The SSA's OIG has stated that it uses these items for investigations into wrongdoings by applicants, beneficiaries, contractors, and third parties and employees. And why they would need guns for nonviolent? It gets worse. The National Park Service of the U.S. Department of Interior purchased nearly 2 million rounds, approximately 1,500 firearms, silencers, riot shields and batons, camouflage uniforms, and pyrotechnics and specialized munitions. The stated purpose of these items is to protect the safety and health of NPS visitors, partners, and staff, as well as our natural and cultural resources. Yeah, I wonder why the silencers play into that. And I wonder why anything more than a handgun for a couple of people at a park service is necessary. Not only is this just disgusting misuse and wasting of taxpayer dollars, for me, this shows you an insight into something much more nefarious going on right around us. The Department of Homeland Security buys 5 bullets for every American person, or every American man, woman, and child, as they wrote it. 5 bullets for every one person that lives in this country. Why is that something? The Department of Homeland Security, they're not overseas fighting some foreign. We're talking about what they do in this country against Americans. Now, obviously, they would claim, oh, it's because, you know, terrorism and whatever. But the reality is that's not something that's actually a day-to-day occurrence for anyone here. So why they would need this much ammunition should be drawing questions, but it doesn't. Now, as the recently released GAO report notes from the years we're talking about, 2010, 2017, non-military federal agencies spent $1.5 billion on ammunition, weapons, and military-grade tactical gear. Now, as an example, during the time frame that we're talking about, the VA bought 11 million rounds of ammunition, roughly equivalent to 2,800 rounds for each of its 3,957 officers. That's astounding. Similarly, the Department of Health and Human Services has purchased 4 million rounds over the past 8 years and acquired 1 million rounds for use by its 461 special agents. The HHS, the Health and Human Services, has called its arms purchases imperative. In addition, the SSA bought 800,000 rounds, the Social Security Agency, 800,000 rounds for their 270 special agents during this period, amounting to nearly 3,000 rounds per agent. Now, even the U.S. Postal Service, as I'm sure is probably alarming for some people, acquired significant amounts of weapons and ammunition. The U.S. Postal Service, what is going on here? Now, these purchases in the past have been the subject of a lot of controversy, and they should be, such as the mass purchases of, I don't know, hollow point rounds by government agencies, including the Forest Service, the National Park Service, Office of Inspector General, the Bureau of Fiscal Services, the Drug Enforcement Administration, U.S. Marshal Service, and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Hollow point rounds. They're illegal under the Geneva Convention, but government agencies spent at least $426,000 just in 2 years to acquire an illegal ammunition. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's unbelievable to me. Now, at the time, Forbes noted that the massive ammo purchases by DHS could be used to sustain a hot war for more than 20 years. Given that, this blew me away, given that during the height of the Iraq War, the Army used about 6 million rounds per month. So with its planned purchase of 1.6 billion rounds, the DHS would have ammo left over after matching the Army's peak daily outpouring of hot lead for 2 solid decades. So at the height of the Iraq War, what they were using in a month time, by that metric, right now the DHS has enough ammo to continue an ongoing constant war like that for 2 decades. Is that not alarming to anybody? Why they think they need this much ammunition for enforcement within the United States? Sure alarms me. And then a perfect example of how the two-party deception and partisan politics are supposed to work. This whole topic drew sharp criticism from the right under Obama. And now that Trump has increased this effort, the same right is oddly silent on the development. I wonder why that is. Just like now Guantanamo is somehow a good thing, the propaganda surrounding the Trump administration and the associated efforts around him have now made the very things we once, the very same people once were scared about, now okay because Trump's there. Because he's fighting the deep state and these people are going, this is the same story we've been hearing. So what happens when a Democrat gets voted in next time and the same things are in place? People need to recognize that one person is not going to change this. I know that people want to believe he's fighting the deep state and it's all going to end and it's all going to come down, and I hope it does too. But the reality is that that's not what the information shows us. And they're continuing to arm non-military personnel in this country. And during Obama, we talked about martial law and the concerns for, you know, controlling an increasingly awakening public with 5G and all things. All these things relate to crowd control. And we need to be aware of that. Now, there's really no denying that these purchases represent a significant amount of just government waste. In addition to all the other concerns we should have, the government waste is astounding. That's your taxpayer dollars, while we're incredibly more in debt than we could ever understand. Now, more importantly, these purchases reveal a gradual yet continual effort to militarize federal agencies that have historically been administrative, a trend that should really concern every American watching this show. Now, while the militarization of domestic police has attracted attention, as we've covered a lot, which is long, that ship has sailed as well. They are straight up militarized. But while that has alarmed some people, it's equally important to ask why regulatory agencies are now also being so heavily armed with machine guns and silencers and all kinds of stuff that the IRS and the Social Security Administration, they don't really need, or the Postal Service for that matter. Considering that virtually all of those pursued by these regulatory agencies are American citizens who are wanted for minor infractions or nonviolent crimes. It's pretty simple. Why no one's asking these questions should also be alarming to you. Now, for instance, in 2016, the Department of Education sent armed U.S. Marshals after Paul Acker over a $1,500 unpaid student loan. This is where we're going. Now, it's no surprise as well that Trump has maintained this obviously unnecessary and wasteful effort, as Trump has had a more than cozy relationship with the U.S. arms manufacturers, as do most all U.S. politicians, which clearly influences their policies. For example, and today, guess who just landed a seat at the board of directors for Boeing? That's right. Former U.S. Ambassador for the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has now been tapped to join Boeing's board of directors. You think that's coincidence? Do you think that doesn't play into all that's been happening and why they fight for the war and the things going on? This is an insight into our very clear revolving door politics, the revolving door corruption of our entire system. Why somebody who was once involved with effecting policy can then find their way on the board of the very group they were fighting for, or the person that's on the board of a group can then find themselves in a position to fight for those policies as they're later in politics. This should not be allowed, and it is. And this is primarily how our entire system functions. Thank you, Dean, for the super chat. I appreciate the support. This just shows all of us, or should anyway, an alarming trend of almost secretly militarizing entire factions of the government, or rather the final story we talked about. And again, the way that this system functions with the revolving door politics is a very important factor to understand on how and why these people get in the positions they do. But truly, in regard to arming all these people in the United States, which is something that's clearly got people are failing to pay attention to, with the increasing constitution free zone around our country, the increasing crackdown on our constitutional rights in general, but primarily our Second Amendment rights. But this really shows us a trend of almost, again, secretly militarizing entire factions of this government without the American public being even truly aware of it at all. All at a time when the U.S. government has never been more hostile towards its own citizens. Truly, never been more hostile in general. It's time to begin paying attention, because things are quickly developing. And if you do not begin taking action now, you'll wake up one day to realize that the option has been removed for you, and it's simply no longer available. All, you know, for your safety, of course. Thank you for tuning in today. As always, I appreciate you spreading this information. If it resonates with you, please get it out there. And if you'd like to support this channel and continue our efforts in sharing the truth, thank you for the Super Chat. You can do so with Super Chats or on Patreon or PayPal or Streamlabs or Bitbacker or any number of things we have in the show notes, as well as buying one of our Question Everything t-shirts from the link in the show notes below, and support this channel and support the truth, or rather our fight for the truth. I love you all. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.